Before I tell you what the book is about, the UFO-Jesus Connection, I think it's best that I tell you what it is not. I am not suggesting that Jesus and God were nothing more than aliens and flying saucers. Far from it. But it seems that if people are going to, even though the biblical UFO hypothesis is not new, it seems that people are going to look at Moses' pillar of cloud and pillar of fire, and Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel, as the forerunners of today's UFOs. Then the Star of Bethlehem and the brilliant cloud to which Jesus ascended must be looked at in the same vein. Now, Bill approached me, he said, if I got anything wrong in that in the newsletter, let me know. Where's Bill hiding? Hey, Bill. Well, you mentioned Misty Scott. Let me tell you the story as I relate it in the book. I was 14 years old, and I was going off to bed one Saturday night, and I looked out my window. It was not a misty sky. It was a perfectly clear sky, okay? But I saw a brilliant cloud was billowing. It appeared to be out of one point in the sky. This cloud of smoke wasn't cloud, moisture cloud. It was a cloud of smoke. And behind it was a shimmering green lights. And I said, Mom, the sky is green. And I heard my father say, go to bed, David. I said, no, really, the sky is green. So my mother came in and she looked out the window. She called my father, Earl, the sky is green. So he gets up, my sister gets up, they go to that side of the house, they look up in the sky. And what is it? I don't know. We ran out from the front lawn. By this time, this was a little bit northeast of us in the sky. By the time we got outside, it had pretty much covered the entire neighborhood. And it was directly over our house. And it was just the smoke was so thick that you could not see the outline of the crack. But as that smoke started to dissipate, you could see huge, round floodlights, perhaps 200 feet above us. And we're standing there speculating, what could this be? Well, I'm 14 years old, I have no idea, I don't care, it's just very fascinating. But then, my mother noticed and she said, look over there. It looked like a pillar of smoke was coming down at one point, as if an air jet was pushing the smoke down, make a little tornado come down. And that's what my mother said, it's the second coming. My mother was a devout Christian all of her life. And when she saw this, she knew it was the second coming. The cloud, the lights, the smoke coming down to earth. Exactly what was described in the Bible is what's going to happen, the second coming. So the lights receded. And by the time they were gone, the smoke had dissipated. The lights were gone, and it was a perfectly clear, star-punctured sky again. We just turned around and walked back in the house. My sister had brought up to me the fact that she remembers it also, that after that spectacular review of a phenomenon to be witnessed, we just said, okay, and walked back in the house. And that was odd in itself. The next day, my father got a newspaper, a Sunday Detroit News, and we never reported that site. However, other people had seen it. It was in the Joy and Southfield area of Detroit, heavily populated area. So, the position it was in the sky, you would have to have seen it from Joy and Southfield all the way to Warren Avenue. You'd have to see it for at least a mile and a half in a radius. Other people had reported it. Well, the government was very quick to tell us what we had seen that night. We saw the Northern Lights. Somehow the Northern Lights had made it all the way down to the west side of Detroit, and that's what we saw. Now, I've never seen the Northern Lights in my life. But I'd seen pictures. I'd seen motion pictures. I did go to school. I saw them on video and movies. And I said, those weren't the Northern Lights. I said, those were round floodlights, different color. In fact, there were no, I don't remember seeing green, but there were red, white, and yellow. Red, white, and yellow. Huge flames. And I think at the angle which I was seeing, the cloud billowing in, they mixed to make green. But at any rate, I said that Northern Lights are not accompanied by smoke either. That would have been 1962.
What day?
That was Saturday. I have no idea. It was the summer. It was in the summer. Okay. And yeah, it would be good to find that newspaper. I would have no idea. But they said it was the Northern Lights. I said, well, it's not accompanied by Northern Lights aren't accompanied by smoke. And she had grown up in East Jordan, Michigan. She had seen Northern Lights. My father had spent 2 years in Alaska. He had seen the Northern Lights. And yet he was banning a god, not knowing what these were, what this vision was. And my mother was ready for judgment day. And my mother said, well, if they say that it was the Northern Lights, then that's what it must have been. So they put it aside, but I have not done so to this day, because I know that we were being lied to. Ever since then, I've been a student of the metaphysics and the Bible and of UFOs. Now, I've read Eric Van Daniken's Chariot of Gods, as most of us have, but they speak there of the, what do they speak of? Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel. I have a picture here. They suggested that Ezekiel, what is being described in the Bible of Ezekiel's vision, was actually the same type of craft that we're seeing today. Perhaps not exactly the same, because he talked about the great roar of the ocean, or the sound of an advancing army, and the fire that came out of it, looked like lightning coming out of this craft. But he also talked about these wings. He likened these cylindrical things with wings. He likened them to living beings. He didn't say they were living beings. He likened them to living beings. So he suggested that that was actually ancient astronauts, and not actually God that came down. Joseph F. Bloomrich read the book and decided to prove him wrong. So he got 6 different copies of the Bible, or different versions, rather, of the Bible. And through the descriptions given, he was able to design, I don't know if anybody can see this, design a craft, a landing craft. Bloomrich was a NASA scientist. He would design these landing craft, one on top. And Ezekiel will talk about the wheel within a wheel. Now, some of us will say, well, that sounds like a UFO. It looks like a wheel within a wheel, the way it spins, okay? But when you read the description in the Bible, this wheel within a wheel was at the base of this craft. At the base of the craft. And it afforded universal movement. Once it was on the ground, Ezekiel could not get over the fact that when the object went up, the wheels went up with it. And when the object came down, the wheels came down with it. Well, it had to, because it was part of it. But a wheel within a wheel, such as this, would allow universal movement without the landing craft having to stop, turn, go this way. It could just roll around like a universal coaster. Some of the artwork from the Renaissance period, religious artwork, depicted men in flying vehicles. The Romans and Greeks, these are from religious paintings. The Romans and Greeks referred to them as flying shields. They were shaped like the shield. They were called flying boats. And in this picture, which is the one that I used for the cover of my book, it's hard to see there, but there's a little dot above Mary's shoulder. And a man in the background and a dog looking up at this dot. This is a blow up of that. Her shoulder, the object that has been painted in here, the man and the dog. I'm going to leave these up here if you want to see them later. Don't look at them a little bit closer. Okay? There's another picture of medieval tapestry depicting the life of the Virgin Mary, and a saucer-shaped craft can be seen overhead. Once again, probably a little hard to see this saucer-shaped craft in the background. However, a lot of medieval artistry where Mary has been, Virgin Mary has been depicted, has this craft in the sky, in the background. Now, yes, this is just a picture. I can paint a picture. You can paint a picture. It doesn't, you know, it isn't a photograph. It isn't a video thing. But where did they get this idea? Where did they get the idea to put this object in the picture? Was this artist kind of fooling with science fiction? Or was this word of mouth stories that had been passed down from generation to generation? Eric Bloomridge, like I said, after studying the descriptions in the Bible, came up with the design and patented this landing craft, and found it was functional. And the lightning that had been described could have been a nuclear reactor, and the lightning was electricity, a static electricity that was going back and forth. When the object went up, the wheels went up. In Ezekiel's mind, the wheels were controlling the craft. But in actuality, the craft was attached to the craft and it was taking it up. This is a picture of done by a NASA scientist of the moon landing. And if you will get this picture in your mind and then look at the read the description of Ezekiel's vision, you'll see how much alike that looks. These pictures are also in the book. Then there was Moses. Harry Downey's book, UFOs, the Bible and Flying Saucers, goes into great detail about Moses. Moses must be mentioned here before getting into Jesus because of an obvious connection. God came to Moses, according to the Bible, and had him go free the slaves from Egypt. Brought all of these devastating plagues upon Egypt to where the Pharaoh, we all know the story, let him go. Well, the point I'm getting at here is the crossing of the Red Sea, the parting of the waters of the Red Sea. This pillar of fire, pillar of smoke, went before the Israelites for 40 years. And these people followed him. And actually, it fed them with manna out in the desert. what they refer to as manna out in the desert. And you say, well, you know, what about if this really was an alien craft? Well, the alien is going to eat for 40 years, you know? But don't forget, God asked them for sacrifices, animal, wheat. So they kind of helped each other across the desert for 40 years. When the Egyptians, when the Pharaoh sent his armies to intercept the Israelites, of course, God, or this vehicle, whatever it was, stepped in. And Barry Downing talks about how an anti-gravitational device over water, a lot of UFOs that are over water will stir up the water. If it's an anti-gravitational device, it can actually push those waters aside. It would have to be awfully strong. But if there was an anti-gravitational device above the craft to counter this, the craft would remain in one spot, while the effect on the water would be to actually push it aside. They talk about in the Bible about a strong east wind that blew the waters apart and held them there, and overnight dried that soggy bed, dried it up to where it was hard ground. And as I mentioned in my book, jokingly, but half jokingly, such a wind that would hold those waters back and dry that land up, dry that soggy seabed up overnight, would have blown the Israelites and the armies back to Egypt anyway. So what they have attributed to, they've attributed the strong east wind as part of the sea. I don't think that was it. It doesn't seem like that would be it. I think they were looking at this technology and say, it's got to be God. They knew then we didn't have anything like that. We know now we don't have anything like that. And what must it look have looked like back then? Well, today we've advanced to the point where, we're not going to say it's God. We see a UFO. We experience a UFO or an abduction. We're not going to say it's God, because we know a little bit more about our universe. Back then, we were all that there was. I mean, you know, they saw what they see in the sky. The sun, the moon, the stars, birds. They knew that this was none of those things. So it must be from God. And then people came out of these things. They had to be God's angels. There's a story, whoever was lucky, fortunate enough to go to the Sierra Pandemic and at Henry Ford College, heard a story about an island in the Pacific. I'm not going to pronounce this right. Malvasia, an island in the Pacific. Anyway, several years ago, this island, the natives were cut off from civilization. They thought they were the only things there on this island. That was their earth. In the 1970s, an expedition of Westerners went to Malvasia. I'm going to call it the island, so I won't mispronounce it again. Went to the island and found that they had a strange religion. They worshipped a god by the name of John Frum, F-R-U-M. God had a name, John Frum. John Frum, it seems, came to this people a while back in a huge iron bird. And these people, to honor their god John Frum, wore a tattoo somewhere on their body, the meaning of which they didn't even understand. And the tattoo was USA. John Frohm, even though he looks strange to these people, must have been God. And this God learned to communicate with them and gave them a helmet, paper money and coins, and a photograph. Now, whether the photograph was of John Frohm or not, we don't know, but it was a photograph of a man. And told him many strange things about the nature of the world, the universe. And when John Frohm departed, he promised to return. Obviously he hadn't. But they were still waiting for their God, John Frohm, to return from his kingdom in America. So this is an example, and just one of the examples that I cite in my book, about how a primitive civilization will respond or react when it's visited by a more advanced technology, more advanced civilization. So if we look back in the Bible days, and it's not just the Bible that makes these statements, it's what we look at as myths that are passed down, whether they're written on parchment, whether they're written on Sanskrit, on the walls of caves. They all seem to have these pictures of the gods with large black eyes, and all seem to have come from the sky. And this is why we perceive heaven as up there. Well, where are you from? I'm from up there. Okay, you're God, and you come from up there, so heaven must be up there. Jesus has told us that God is spirit. Why God would need a vehicle to get down here, I have no idea. But we have gone further and further and further. We go out into space with a Hubble telescope. The more we see, heaven's not out there. I mean, it's got to be a long way. It's got to be a long way. Jesus was asked, where is heaven? Where is heaven? Said he's, heaven is within your midst. Now they changed that in the Bible as the translations changed. And he said, heaven is within you. Now, at first blush, that sounds like the same thing. Within you, within your midst. But it's not real. I could easily say to you, well, it's not, that doesn't mean the same thing. It means inside your body. That's where the kingdom of God is. That's where heaven is. But they changed it because people would say, what do you mean within your midst? Right here? Yeah, I think right here. Right here. There's a lot that has happened in my life, the people around me, to tell me that where our souls go when this chunk of clay falls is right here. Right here. My grandmother, of course, a fundamentalist Christian, when you die, you go in the ground, your soul goes up there, because that's where God's from, and when Jesus comes back, he's going to dig you up, and he's going to put that soul back in there, and you're going to live forever. Well, this is wonderfully simplistic, but it always left me scratching my head. Even at a young age, I was into the metaphysics. And I said, Grandma, if it's possible, when you die, come back and knock on the walls for me, okay? It's not possible. But if it is possible, Grandma, it's not possible. But if it is, come back and knock, okay, I will do it. And now the kid shut up, and she was happy. But the fact was forged, she was going to knock on the walls when she died. I grew up, I went off to the army, I got married, went off to the army, came back. It was several years later before my grandmother passed away. And a couple months after her death, her house, my grandfather moved in with my mother, and the house was sold. The furnishings were taken out and the house was sold to a real estate agent. And time was growing short. they were going to sell the house, or the keys were going to be given up in a day or two. And I haven't had many out-of-body experiences, but I have had out-of-body experiences, and I know the difference between them and a fanciful dream. Out-of-body experience, to me, is a memory that hasn't happened yet. A memory of something that hasn't happened yet. That's a precognitive dream. But I can tell the difference. At any rate, I had an out-of-body experience one night, and I was in my grandmother's house. Now, I had not been there since when I was there in the house last, physically, the furnishings were still there. I had grown up knowing this house and its furnishings. If I were going to have a dream about this house, it would have these furnishings. There were no furnishings. There were no furnishings in this house, just like it actually was. And I went to the bedroom where my grandmother had died. And I looked in, and there was my grandmother, but she looked exactly like she did. She died of cancer, and she lingered for 5 months before she died, and she did not look good when she died. She was there, and she presented herself to me the way she did before she passed, which was kind of scary. And she came up to me and put her arms around me, and I backed off a little bit and kind of repelled her. And she came up to me again, and I repelled her again. And I heard a woman's voice, and I looked over here, and there's a woman that I recognize but can't place. She must have been a family member. And she says, this woman said to my grandmother, "You're scaring him, Florence." And my grandmother presented herself like she, as she did before the ravages of cancer took her. And she came up and hugged me. And I could accept her like that. I don't remember seeing this woman again, this other woman. And I said, "Grandma, you know you're dead." She said, "No." First she said, "I can't get out of the house." I said, "Grandma, you're dead. You can walk right through the walls." "No, I can't. They've come, they've taken all my furniture. But they've left me here and I can't get out of the house." I said, "Grandma, you can walk right through the wall." "No, I can't do that." I said, "Grandpa." I said, "Grandpa's at living at Mom's house. You want to go see Grandpa, don't you?" "Yeah." I said, "Come in." We went in the living room. I said, "This wall, walk right through it." "I can't." "Here we go again, all right." I said, "Just walk right through the wall." "All right, she'll try." And she walked up to the wall and bounced off of it and fell on the floor. Of course, in her mind, she could not reach the wall. And for a moment, I had forgotten that she was in spirit, and I guess so was I. And she could not get hurt, but seeing this frightened me. And I went, "Grandma," and fell down to one knee to help her, and the shock of this drew me back into my body. And I woke up, and I was paralyzed for a few seconds. I found out later that to a book called Projection of the Astral Body by Sylvain Muldoon and Hayward Carrington, that when something shocks you, when you're out of body, and you snap back, it'll snap you back into the body, and you'll be slightly out of coincidence with the physical. And you will be paralyzed for a few seconds until you settle down again. At any rate, I was convinced that my grandmother was stuck in that house. So I went over to my mother's house and asked for the key. I told her what had happened. Of course, my mother, "Okay, it'll make you happy. So make the kid happy. Here's the key. Go over." I went over there and I talked to the walls. There's nobody there except Grandma to see me. "Grandma, if you're here, you are dead. You can leave. You can walk through the walls. Just walk right through the walls." And then I don't remember what had happened. Last time she tried to walk through the walls. So I went to the front door. I opened the door. I held it open. I said, "This is your last chance to get out. You're dead. You don't have to remain here. Leave." And I closed the door. But I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. I wasn't physical at that time. And I went home. This was end of November, the 1st of December, was the very next day, I went to bed. We had a dog by the name of Buck. As I say in my book, he's Buck's mother was a German Shepherd, and the father was well respected in the neighborhood. So Buck, of course, protected the house. We had two small children at the time. And around 3 o'clock in the morning, about 4 or 5 loud bangs woke my wife and I up. And the dog is barking. But if someone came to the door and knocked, that dog would be right there at the door. And the dog is barking and looking around, which I couldn't figure out. I ran to the front door. Nobody's there. I looked out every window. I see nothing. I looked in on the kids. They're sleeping. Yeah. Got the dog settled down, and I'm really mad at this prankster. I'm laying there. My wife says, just go back to sleep. Just go back to sleep. And, they're gone. And now I know I'm wide awake, because I can't get back to sleep. It was about 10 minutes after this that I tried to go back to bed. About 3 or 4 reps, and the dog started barking. Well, I was on my feet at the first bang and the first bark. And the dog was standing there looking around again. And I could see now why the dog's acting like this. There didn't seem to be a source of this pounding. It seemed to be emanating from the walls, all the house. Ran to the front door. I completely ran around the house and did the whole thing again. Nothing. Now I'm mad. Now I'm swearing up a storm at this prankster. Who in the world is doing this stuff? I got back to bed, and finally I got back to sleep. Next morning I put my coat on, went outside, and I walked around. It started to snow that evening around 11 o'clock. It had started to snow. I thought, there's got to be footprints. I walked all the way around the house, and twice, no footprints. And then I remembered my grandmother's and my pet. Grandma. Sorry about the language, Grandma. And I thought, it must be good. Temple. The Star of Bethlehem. Once again, they only knew the moon, the sun, the stars, the birds. And when they saw this light moving slow enough to where 3 guys on camelback can follow it, and then it stopped and shone its light directly down on one spot. What else could it be? It wasn't the moon. Because at nighttime it wasn't the sun. It certainly wasn't a bird. Birds have much dimmer lights, I guess. I don't know. But it had to be a star. So they called it a star. But it did not act like a star. What else moves that way? Well, it certainly couldn't have been an extraterrestrial craft, because we're the only thing in the entire universe. We're it, and everything else revolves around us. There's nobody out there. We're it. So they put it together, and that's what it is. But for so long, we had seen these beings come down, and always with the idea of teaching us moral standards, teaching us about a God, a spiritual God, that is over the entire universe. And we revered them as God, and we revered them as angels of God. And Jesus told us God is spirit. So, if God is spirit, then these angels must be spirit. Hidden in the Apocrypha is a verse that where an angel comes to Mary and said, don't be afraid, and don't confuse me with a spirit. Well, if you're not a spirit, right? Had to be physical. That is one of the verses that were hidden in the Apocrypha. I believe that nobody wanted to answer that question. Why are they saying they're not, don't confuse me with the spirit? How many times have you yourself, or those of you who are abductees or experiencers, been told or read about it? Those who were told by these beings, don't be afraid. You're not going to be hurt. I'm not going to hurt you. Don't be afraid. Fear not is the Elizabethan English way of saying that. Fear not. How many fear nots or don't be afraid can you find in the Bible where these beings, these angels have come down and said, fear not. Mary, the Star of Bethlehem, from the Apocrypha, we saw an extraordinary large star shining amongst the stars of heaven, and so outshined all of the other stars that they became not visible. You don't read something like that in the regular Bible. In 1796, a lot of these verses were pulled out of the Bible and stuck in a book called the Apocrypha. But what kind of a star could do that? Some people say, some scientists say it was a comet, a fireball, a meteor, the planet Venus, a supernova. And one even said that it was an eclipse of the planet Jupiter. Yeah, David goes, I go. Eclipse, by its nature, blocks out the light. Does not get a light that is so bright that it outshines all the other stars. But that's what they wanted to say about it, that it was these different things. They have not nailed it yet. In the book, The Watchers, you're familiar with Paulo's book, The Watchers. Betty Andrea Lucas, Luca, right? Betty Andreas and Luca, very young, right? When she was a child, under hypnosis, she recalled about 12 years old, she was in Long Beach at a pool, swimming pool. She went to the bathhouse to change into her swimsuit. And two men came to the door. And they simply said to her, it's time to go. You have to come with us. Well, of course, at first she didn't want to go with these strange men. But she felt compelled to do so. So she went with them. And as she did, it was broad daylight, as she did, she noticed that the swimming pool where children had been splashing water on each other, the children were frozen in place. Big drops of water were suspended in air above them. As they walked down, as these two men and Betty walked down the walk, there were people frozen in mid-stride. It was like walking through a three-dimensional photograph. There is a correlation that, of course, was hidden in the Apocrypha. Joseph was with Mary when she went into labor, and he put her in a cave and walked to Bethlehem to get a midwife. Walked to Bethlehem to get a midwife. Now this is Joseph's office. But as I was going, I looked up into the air and I saw the clouds astonished, and the fowls of the air stopping in the midst of their flight. And I looked down towards the earth and I saw the table spread and working people sitting around it. But their hands were upon the table and they did not move to eat. They who had meat in their mouths did not eat. They who lifted their hands up to their heads did not draw them back. And they who lifted them up to their mouths did not put anything in. But all their faces were fixed upward. And I beheld the sheep dispersed, and yet the sheep stood still. And the shepherd lifted up his hand to smite them, and his hand continued up. And I looked onto the river and saw the kids with their mouths close to the water and touching it, but they did not drink. This was a passage that was pulled from the Bible. Suspended animation, very much like was witnessed by not only Betty Luka, but many others. It is a little bit more rare, I believe, but it happens. And it's a correlation, another correlation from biblical script. So I guess what I'm getting at is that these anomalies, aerial anomalies, aerial phenomena that were present in the Old Testament are now showing up in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, back with Moses, there was the Ark of the Covenant and what was called the Mercy Seat. Eric Van Doniken used the Bible in this description to go ahead to rebuild the Ark of the Covenant. God told Moses how to build the Ark of the Covenant. And so they mean what to wear, what kind of footwear to put on their feet when they approach this thing, and don't touch it without being properly prepared, or you will die. Well, we know that one man touched it and dropped dead. Eric Van Doniken rebuilt this thing according to the instructions and found that the Ark of the Covenant was an electronic condenser capable of generating and storing hundreds of volts of electricity. And then we can understand why this guy died when he touched it, when he wasn't prepared. Also, the mercy seat, it was referred to, is where Moses was able to go to talk to God, and God would talk back to him. And they could have conversation between the two of them. When Eric Van Doniken used the description to rebuild the mercy seat, he found that it was a loudspeaker capable of two-way communication. Now, why would God, the Spirit, need an electronic condenser? Why would God need a loudspeaker if he wants to talk to us? And yet, in the Bible, back in Moses' day, they could go to the mercy seat and talk to God and hear his voice. It says so right in the Bible. They heard God's voice. When Mary was pregnant with Jesus, was this before? Oh, yes. Before she became pregnant with Jesus, the angel came to her and said, "Don't confuse me with the Spirit. And you're going to have a child. Even though you're a virgin, you're going to have a child. And you're going to call him Jesus." Well, who shall be the father? We have to go. In the Apocrypha, it says that they went to the mercy seat to ask who the father should be, who should take care of her. And they all heard at the mercy seat God speak to them and say, "Joseph." So it's obvious that mercy seat, or that communications device, was still present in Jesus' day as it was in Moses. And it obvious that whoever it was, be it God or aliens, whoever you want to, extraterrestrials, or whatever you want to call them, was still in communication with man. In the September issue of 1998, issue of MUFON's journal, Malcolm Smith, who holds two degrees in the field of zoology, it's obviously we're coming to the hybridization, human alien hybridization, it denounces the fact that it's possible for humans and aliens to create a hybrid Because he says humans and lower animals share the same genetic code. The biochemical makeups between man and lower animals are simply variations on the same theme. In a cell with a different genetic code, the alien gene could not produce a chemical it is coded to produce. So here he is telling us what the alien gene is about. How he found out what the alien gene is about, I have no idea. But he tells us that they can't get together. It doesn't mean that just because a dog and an ape have the same basic genetic code, doesn't mean we could have a hybrid. But he's saying that the alien gene would be so far different than the human gene that we couldn't make a hybrid. So human-alien hybridization is impossible, he says, because the DNA of humans and that of extraterrestrial beings is not compatible. Well, I agree with them to a point. I agree with them. But you could also say, you can rephrase that without taking it out of context. You can say human hybridization is impossible unless the DNA of humans and that of extraterrestrials is compatible. Now that opens a whole new can of worms. It takes us back to Genesis where God said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness. Which begs the question, who is God talking to at this time? And when people had spread all over the world and daughters were being born, some of the heavenly beings saw that these young women were beautiful, so they took the ones they liked. And then the Lord said, I will not allow people to live forever, they are mortal. From now on they will live 120 years. I don't know what happened there. In those days and even later, there were giants on the earth who were descendants of human women and the heavenly beings. They were the great heroes and famous men of long ago. These stories, including the Bible, of heavenly beings coming down and mating with earthly women to make what they call giants, giants in the earth. And yet the word giant is actually translated from the word Nephilim. Nephilim, literally translated, means those who came down. It doesn't mean giant. It means those who came down. And even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we will find references to angels who came down and interbreeded with human women. So as hard as it might be to try to say, well, Jesus had the mother, a human mother, an alien father or an extraterrestrial father, but his spirit was that of the spiritual God. And it seemed like he had come here to try to tell us, you are looking at the messengers of God, because the God is spirit, and he is the same God of you, and of you, and of every being, every physical being, every spiritual being, in the entire universe. But you are looking at these messengers, these missionaries of God, and you're revering them as God. So go with the spiritual side and not with the physical side, because this is not necessary. There's one more picture I wanted to show you. I don't know if you're probably familiar with this picture, the Shroud of Turin. There's an ongoing debate as to the Shroud of Turin. Some say, one scientist says it's nothing more than a painting. Well, they've proven it's not a painting. It could not be a painting. in fact, as I mentioned in my book, a painting. This kind of a painting, after all that they have gone through to examine. To do a painting like this would be more miraculous than the resurrection itself. So it is not a painting. But there are X-ray type markings on this where you could see the bones in the hand, the root of the teeth, the bones in the leg where the skin is most thin. It is like an overlay of flesh on the bone. The only thing that can cause an X-ray effect like this is radiation. They didn't have radiation. Anything can cause radiation, to my knowledge, back then. But going back to the Apocrypha, and I'm going to find the words. There was a light in the sky. The Roman guards witnessed a light in the sky, and this light shone down upon the cave where Jesus was buried, and frightened away the guards, and made that stone that covered the mouth of the cave roll of itself. And two men came down from the sky, from that light, and went into the cave. The Bible doesn't say that. The Apocrypha does. These are some of the verses that were pulled out of there. But this light, there's been so much, Vicki Landrum and Landrum, help me with this. Landrum and Cash. Cash Landrum came, thank you. Where they were injured by radiation. And this happens again and again. That's just one example. But there seems to be radiation as a property of this light. And whatever properties this light had, it rolled the stone away. And as soon as it did, it shone into the cave. And it shone on the body of Jesus. And not only putting the imprint on the cloth, on the shroud, which he was wrapped, but causing the X-ray effect that they are able to see today, and reanimating the physical body. There are things that suggest that this reanimation of Jesus' body was taking the atoms and reverse polarity in the atoms. Because the only thing that's stopping my hand from going through this wood is the fact that these atoms act like magnets holding this together, but repel each other. If you reverse the polarity in the atoms in my hand and leave this alone, my hand would go right through it, because it would be like two magnets. Two negative or two positive sides that are repelling. Reverse it, and it attracts, it goes right through. Because Jesus told Mary Magdalene, don't touch me. I haven't yet ascended, so don't touch me. So she didn't touch him. What if she had touched him? Would her hands have gone right through him, or vice versa? We'll also explain how he got into the upper room where his disciples were. The doors were locked. And yet he appeared within that room. Was it because of his spirit? It will have been, but then we have to go back to the resurrection itself, to where the light caused this physical body to be reanimated and caused the shroud, the image on the shroud. And yet, we want to keep, especially those who are abductees or experiencers, They want to keep the faith and these experiences as two separate things. They don't want to make that connection. And I don't blame them. It would be terrible, horrific, to think that the source of our fears and the source of our faith is all part and parcel of the same phenomenon. And it was one of the hardest, most grueling things that I had to go through trying to make this connection in my mind, in light of the evidence that I put forth in this book and that has been put forth in many books. In light of that evidence, it's the only conclusion I can come to. But my mind is always open. I never claimed to be a devout Christian, but I too have grown up in a Christian-oriented, a church-oriented atmosphere. And I've come to accept the Bible teachings as fact. So, accepting this or coming to this conclusion was one of the hardest things that I've ever done. What would it be for a truly devout Christian to make that connection? It would help by realizing that everything in God's universe is connected directly, indirectly. It's connected one way or the other. My mother, a devout Christian all of her life, made that connection years ago. She never acknowledged it. She never even realized it. And yet the connection was made. It's the second coming, she declared. As our family stood on our front lawn one silent summer's night and gazed in awe upon technology millennia beyond our time.
Ancient astronaut and biblical UFO hypothesis are not new. However, no one seems to want to take the matter to the next logical step. If Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel and Moses' pillar of fire and cloud were forerunners of today's UFOs, then the Star of Bethlehem and the brilliant cloud to which Jesus ascended must be treated in the same vein. In a thought-provoking book, The UFO-Jesus Connection, David Twitchell takes the next step to draw the correlation between a physical Jesus and a spiritual God. To order The UFO-Jesus Connection, go to buybooksontheweb.com, Amazon or Borders.com, or you can save the shipping charges and order your autographed copy by sending a check or money order for $13.95 U.S. funds to David Twitchell, P.O. Box 511, Trenton, Michigan, 48183-0511. That's David Twitchell, P.O. Box 511, Trenton, Michigan, 48183-0511. The UFO Jesus Connection. Are you willing to risk having your worldview shaken?
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.